Welcome to Kosher Queers, a podcast with at least two Jews and generally more than three opinions. Each week we bring you queer takes on Torah, their jazz.
And she's Lulav.
And she's Nora. And today we're going to talk about Va'era.
One, two, three, four.
I am really excited that Nora's with us this week. Nora Chernov is a trans-Jewish educator and community builder who loves getting lost in the texts, ideas, and practices of our tradition. She graduated from the Rochester Institute of Technology in 2017, where she also served as the solo professional for Jewish student life for 2 years after graduating. Nora relocated to Philadelphia in the fall of 2019 and currently works for Aleph, the Alliance for Jewish Renewal. She is known for having strong opinions on Jewish texts, podcast, politics, and tabletop role-playing games. Nora, your bio notes that you moved the fall of 2019, but it doesn't note that we met also in the fall of 2019, 2 weeks before you moved, which was delightful. We met at jail support for the Tisha B'Av protest, which it was fantastic. What a good way to meet a person.
Yeah, it was really quite lovely, and it was a great experience, and then I slept for like a day and a half afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
So, Nora, you're in roughly the same physical location as our audio editor, Ezra, right?
Ezra and I were at shul and sat next to each other last night.
Good. I'm so glad.
Yeah, no, Ezra has become a very dear friend as well. So, yes, very proximate.
Cool. Next week's guest, Chesed, also sits pretty close to me at shul. So, I'm glad that we're bringing shul buddies on.
That's great. All right, Lulav, how long do you want for your summary this week?
I'm going to say 50 seconds.
Okay.
And hopefully not be struck down by my hubris.
Okay. It looks short. I feel like we can aspire to it. All right, ready, set, go.
Last time on Shemot, we had a covenant, and the being God will see it through. Moshe is Levi's great-grandson, apparently. The game is rigged, but our intrepid hero starts it off by playing with the big boys. First plague, the river of life becomes a river of blood. Second plague, Aharon joins the shenanigans with Anurakinesis, and we're unbindingly promised a holiday by Pharaoh. The brothers make gnats and flies, except for in Goshen, and Pharaoh makes a prayer closet. Cow plagues, human plagues, and weather plagues get us temporary and empty promises. Done.
That was so fast. You had 13 seconds left. You probably could have done it in 30 seconds.
Amazing.
That was impressive.
Yeah, there's a lot of formulaic stuff happening, and I think this is also shorter than a lot of the parshot around it.
Mm. And see, I would get so lost and just like, why is the formula slightly off though right now that I would never be able to do a quick summary like that.
That's very fair. I did condense all of the three plagues into one.
Yeah. It is interesting that we only get three of them, but...
Well, we get the first seven?
We get six.
Six.
Six?
Yes, but we do not get the last three of them.
Mm.
Anyway, are we ready to dive into the beginning of it?
I would love to.
Okay, first, God speaks to Moses and introduces herself and says, I appeared to your forefathers as El Shaddai, but you're the one who gets my full and real name. And this is, I believe, the first time we get the Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh as a name. And then God says, I've heard that the Israelites are moaning and in bondage, and I'm going to free you through miracles, and you'll know that it was me who did it, and you'll get out of this land. But the Israelites were kind of crushed about it. Their spirits were not able to be raised by Moshe telling them what's going to happen.
Jazz, when you say moaning and in bondage, this is the safe for work and profoundly evil kind, right?
Oh my God.
Okay, cool. Just checking.
Love that combination, both safe for work and profoundly evil. That seems like the fine way that we organize priorities. Anyway.
Okay. Yeah, so in a totally different way, I have some questions about what's going on here.
Yes, please.
So a couple things. One, you mentioned about the different name for God we get, which is really interesting to me, mostly because it means that I hate reading English translations of Torah going forward from this point, because translating the tetragrammaton as Lord is like the thing that makes me want to like run out of a building screaming sometimes. Even though there's like a lot of really good reasoning for actually going into that, right? And who's authoring and codifying when from a historical perspective, it still is like, okay, but I bump off this a lot.
So Nora, in my short summary, I said the being God. Do you feel like, does that make you want to scream or just kind of like moan or what are you thinking?
No, I'm into that. Like, that's fine. It's really just like, sometimes I have a bone to pick with priestly voices in Torah.
Yeah.
And very fair.
We're really in priestly voice territory.
It's true.
That complexity is part of why I like Torah study. Being able to be angry with it is the best part of Torah, in my opinion. But also, it's a little bit frustrating. And then the other thing that you mentioned with Moses trying to like tell the Israelites, it's fine, God's here, and it not working. There's some like interesting translation going on there. And I think it was, there was a footnote in one of the various versions that I read that references the Rashi about this. Because the word for soul and spirit is the same as the word for breath, right? They share a root.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then it was like, it's both a metaphysical bondage has made it so that they are so beaten down that they can't see hope. And also there physically isn't the energy to follow this idea, right? Like there is no breath left because bondage has drained them of it. And then, is this also where we get Moses saying, I can't talk to people, or does that come a little bit later?
I believe that was last chapter.
We have both. So we had a lot of it last chapter, but so yes, right after this, they wouldn't listen to him, and then God says this time, okay, go and tell Pharaoh, and Moshe says to God, okay, but the Israelites didn't listen to me, and why would Pharaoh then listen to me? And then does say, yes, me who gets tongue-tied.
So that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Because that's not what the Hebrew says.
Ooh, what does the Hebrew say?
The Hebrew says of uncircumcised lips.
What?
Yes, I love that. Can you read that real quick?
Yeah, give me 1 second. The JPS translates it as, but Moses appealed to the Lord, saying, the Israelites would not listen to me. How then should Pharaoh heed me, a man of impeded speech? But the Hebrew is Va'ani aral sifatatim, which is, and me with uncircumcised lips or uncircumcised language, which I think is interpreted both to be a physical impediment of some sort, right? But also there's notes about a ritual purity of speech, right? And I think this is something that we see a lot with Moses in particular that differentiates him from the other figures that we follow in Bereishit, that Moses is actually like really plagued by doubt a lot of the time. Right. And we see it again and again, right? That Moses doesn't see himself as actually capable in this way. And that phrase of uncircumcised lips to me is such a, like, I'm not prepared to do this. That is a really fascinating pivot from these very intensive patriarchs who are also like the ones who are in charge of everything. Right.
Yeah.
You know, we're not dealing with the house of Yitzhak anymore. Right. It is B'nai Yisrael. It is the children of Israel. It's all of them. And as much as Moses has that higher status than them from a bunch of different ways, he doesn't have it implicitly. He doesn't implicitly have that power. And he doesn't see himself as able to carry this message either.
So the reason that I asked you about the Hebrew is that called the Amidah where we pray Adonai Sifatai Tiftach?
Yeah, it's at the end of the Amidah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What's the latter half? Ufi Yagid Tehilatecha?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So there's a tune where it's Adonai Sifatai Tiftach Ufi Yagid Tehilatecha. And then it does it in English. Adonai, open up my mouth that my words may declare your praise, I think.
Yeah.
But like, whenever we do that tune, I say, circumcise my lips that my mouth may declare your praise, because it's etymologically related to what Moshe says here. Like, how then shall Pharaoh listen to me? I am uncircumcised of lips.
Huh. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I just really like the whole thing about, like, cutting the covenant. Yeah.
That's super cool. All right, can we keep going?
Yeah.
Our next bit, Moshe says that to God, who doesn't even dignify this with a response, really, but instead gives more instructions, and then we go immediately into genealogy, right in the middle here, and it mostly appears to be the genealogy for Moshe and Aharon, where they come from, so mm-hmm. we get which tribe they are. But we do get a couple other families, and then we note that they're Levites, and also see their parents. There is Amram, who took to wife his father's sister, Yocheved, and Amram and Yocheved are their parents.
Not to be confused with Rambam.
Uh-huh. And so we get this genealogy, and then we're like, yeah, so it's these people, Aaron and Moshe. And then they repeat a little bit of it, saying, like, Moshe appealed to God, saying, see, I get tongue-tied, or I have circumcised lips. How, then, should Pharaoh listen to me? And now we get God's reply, which is... It says here, see, I place you in the role of God to Pharaoh with your brother Aharon as your prophet. And then gives more instructions of like, you'll speak and he'll speak and Pharaoh won't listen and there will be many miracles. And then eventually everybody shall know that I'm God and you shall leave the land. And then we get their ages when this happened, which are 80 and 83 respectively.
Oh my God, I missed that part.
These old men are about to throw down also.
So, do we know what word is used for, see, I have made you like God to Pharaoh? Like, the word for God?
It's Elohim.
Got it.
I've made you like a court of gods?
Elohim is a name for God in and of itself.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit more generic. It's not quite the right word. You would only use it for God. It's not like you would use it for, like, talking about Egyptian gods.
It's plural, right? It's like multiple gods as one god.
Yeah, it's a name for God that we see a lot, especially in the creation story.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mostly ask because I think this is working in the polytheistic system where, like, Pharaoh is a representative of a bunch of gods, but so is Moshe, except for the bunch of gods are, like, the one being God. I don't know. I just like God names.
Yeah, no.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and we're in the midst of it now, right? So.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. Small note that my translation, to your point earlier, Nora, doesn't use the word Lord. We default to the eternal as our one when they're not just saying God.
That's lovely. Mm-hmm. I like my other translations that I have and also am frustrated with them. That's not true. The Everett Fox's Five Books of Moses will do YWYH, which is also interesting.
That's nice, also.
YHWH?
Yes, that would make more sense, right?
Because it's Yod-Heh Vav-Heh.
You know, spelling is not one of my gifts, okay?
You are so valid and have many other gifts.
So, having been given these instructions, they go out and Moshe instructs Aharon and they cast down the walking staff and it turns into a snake. And Pharaoh is like, well, we can do that too. And he summons his sorcerers and magician priests. And they also turn staffs into snakes.
To be fair, who else would you summon?
And then we're like, okay, but we can do better. And Aharon's swallowed the other snakes. But Pharaoh still does not respond in any way. And this does not count as one of the miracles, apparently.
I guess that's only a plague specifically on the sorcerer priests, rather than on, like, the whole of the Egyptians.
Yeah, they're just dunking on the courtiers here.
You know, if... depending on how their magic's working also, right? It could be, like, it's a whole thing to go make a new staff that, like, is attuned, right? It's a whole...
Yeah. I think that I'm going to add something to my personal Haggadah, which is the one dunk and the 10 plagues.
Okay, and so then God is like, well, Pharaoh's being stubborn about it. Bring the snake staff and talk to him in the morning when he's going down to the river and gets instructions about turning the water into blood. And then both of the brothers go and turn the water into blood. Again, the magician priests come and are like, we can do that too. So they do that. And all of the regular Egyptians are suffering because they can't drink the water and the fish are dying and it's a pain in the neck. This first plague happens for 7 days, and then Moshe goes on God's instructions and is like, I can do another one. Do you want me to do another one?
I have a lot of thoughts about this in terms of, like, when injustice needs to be overthrown in dramatic ways, right? Like, who gets targeted and who suffers and who has to deal with the repercussions, right? Because the...
Mm-hmm.
We'll get there, but there's some really interesting ideas about separating out that come up later for me. Mm-hmm. But also, like, if I was in Hebrew school and they had told me, like, for the, like, fifth time that we were learning about the plagues, like, also, there's a wizard fight happening as this is going on, like, you know... I was reading Charlie Bone at that point. This is exactly that type. Like, give it to me, you know?
Right. I always forget about the fact that there are magician priests happening, even though that's so metal.
Yeah.
Wait, Nora, how old are you?
I'm 24.
Okay. Charlie Bone. Wild.
You know, I was not on the train of the other British wizard boy. So give me my X-Men who are also really, like, dorky theater kids, right?
Also, I don't think we've said it on this podcast yet, but Magneto was right, IMO. And anytime that Magneto is not right, it's the writer's fault, not his.
I don't know that I disagree, so yeah.
I don't know enough about my X-Men, except that I know that Magneto is Jewish and tragic and villainous and lovely, and that people who seem to have good opinions believe that.
Shout out to the time that Magneto and Kitty Pryde visit a Holocaust memorial together. It's yeah. a time, aww. And they do a really great job of it, actually. And comics are good sometimes, it turns out. Not often enough, but sometimes.
Not written by Nazis. Oh, boy.
Yeah, well, okay, anyway, so, wait, I do actually have one question for the two of you, and then we can move on to more plagues, but why do we think blood is first?
So, this is a really obvious one, like, it's the Nile. It's a really important thing that affects basically everybody in Egypt. That is my take on that. Nora, do you have anything?
I actually don't really, like, I think it's dramatic. I think it's a really haunting visual. I think it also is kind of... There's an element to which it's effective for Moses and Aaron, I think, also. Right? Like, We don't know how on board they are at this point, right? Like, we know that they're more on board than they were, right? Mm-hmm. But, like, also, listen to what I tell you and you'll turn the river into blood is like, okay, yeah, there might be something here that's going on.
Why am I dumping all these phosphates in the water? I don't understand. And then there's an algal bloom.
What? Sorry?
Algal bloom. So in the modern day, you get a lot of farming runoff where there are phosphates in the water, and the phosphates overfeed the algae, which causes them to grow and be, like, red and stinky and take up all the oxygen.
Oh, fascinating.
And everything dies. So it's basically like we're poisoning water supplies with gigantic things of blood.
Okay. Fascinating. So after the blood, then is frogs. And there are frogs all over. And it's very dramatic, right? They enter your palace, your bedchamber and your bed, the houses of your courtiers and your people, and your ovens and your kneading bowls. The frogs shall come up on you and on your people and on all your courtiers. And then they do, and then Pharaoh's like, get rid of them.
Are you saying that one morning when Pharaoh awoke in his bed, there were frogs in his bed and frogs on his head, frogs on his nose and frogs on his toes, frogs here, frogs there, frogs were jumping
frogs
everywhere?
Jumping everywhere? Yeah.
I love this. Is this another, like...
Yeah, it's a children's song.
My mother taught Jewish nursery school for over 20 years, so we still sing that at our Seder.
Frogs here, frogs there. Frogs were jumping everywhere.
Wow. Oh, I would really like to see a Jewish horror film where they have that song, but it's like really menacingly sung by disembodied children.
Stop. Anyway, Pharaoh's like, you have to get rid of the frogs. And Moshe's like, when? And Pharaoh's like, tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Which has very much energy of, I don't know that I can say right now. Like, why tomorrow? Anyway.
It's a lot of frogs, my guy.
So, one quick thing that I did notice, and I think this came up in the Ultra translation. This idea that the Nile, like, affects Pharaoh, but doesn't affect Pharaoh directly. Whereas this is like an invasion of royal property and space in a way that, like, okay, now it's starting to get a little bit personal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the frogs don't just hop off into the sunset. They die in place, and they pile them in big heaps. But Pharaoh's like, okay, but now the frogs are gone. We don't have any problem anymore. And so God is like, uh-uh, lice now. And this is the first one where the magician priests can't make lice the same way.
Oh, and I want to point out that Pharaoh is hardening his heart every time that a plague is revoked. He's just like, nah, what did we just talk about? I'm not going to let you do whatever I just said I'd let you do.
Mm-hmm. And this one, the priests say, this is the finger of God, because they can't do it. And if they can't do it, it's got to be God. And then there's insects, and heavy swarms of insects come.
So with the insects is also the first time that we get a distinct separation of these plagues are going to happen to you, but not to the Israelites, which is a really interesting thing of both, like, it's another differentiation between the power that God has and the power that these, like, magician priests have. But also so much of what our current conception of, like, what holiness will look like and contemporary Jewish practice is built around ideas around separation. Mm-hmm. And so much of our liturgy, right? And to also see the separation, though, of carving out exceptions and carving out space where some people are targeting some others. And it's like, I am, like, a lifelong reconstructionist, right? Like, chosenness has never been a part of my Judaism. And so it's interesting there, right? And it's, the separation is being made between Egypt and Bnei Israel, but it's not being made between Bnei Israel and the Egyptians who are in power and Joe Schmo Egyptian, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which, like, I feel multiple ways about. I think that if your society is built off the oppression of others, everyone is responsible for it, regardless of their status in society, right?
Oh, fair, yes.
And also, not everyone has the power to be making that change.
Right. And we talked about in one of the previous episodes, Joseph gets to consolidate a lot of power in the hands of authority. And so the Egyptian people, I mean, yes, this one is years later, but we have no reason to believe that the Egyptian economy has changed drastically since then. And so the setup is most people are serfs who sort of can only live on government-controlled areas and, like, with government-controlled food supply and all of those different types of things. And then you have the Israelites who are below that, but it is not like most people are doing great, just the ruling class and the priests. Okay, so Pharaoh says, go sacrifice, but do it inside the land. And Moshe says, we can't. We have to go far away to do it. And Pharaoh says, well, you can go, but not very far. And get rid of the insects when you do.
If you don't mind.
Yeah.
Also, I would like to apologize. There are, in fact, 7 plagues in this parsha. It's just that I forgot that there was a difference between gnats/mosquitoes/lice and flies.
Mm-mm. Yeah. Also, okay, this is a really small side note, but there is a note here. Moshe asks God, and God gets rid of the insects. And the next line is, but Pharaoh became stubborn this time also and would not let the people go.
Mm-hmm.
So my family does a lot of singing on Passover too, and this reminded me in particular of a song that we do every year that's called The 5 Constipated Men.
Yep. Uh-huh.
Which includes Pharaoh among them. He's, I don't know, number 4 or whatever, because he would not let them go.
Yep. Truly, it's a special song in the Ashkenazi canon.
All right, so then livestock, all of them, horses and donkeys and camels and cattle and sheep, get really sick. And again, there's this distinction, the livestock of the Israelites and the livestock of the Egyptians, and which ones die. And we have a specific time. It happens the next day. And Pharaoh looks into it and finds out that that's the case. And that happens to the animals. And then God asks Moshe and Aharon to help out with the next plague. Each of you take handfuls of soot and throw it up towards the sky. And it'll become a dust all over the land of Egypt. And everybody, humans and animals, get boils.
Truly the most dramatic pocket sand of all time.
And the boils are so bad that the magicians can't show up.
Yeah. Not only can they not help, they're, like, really laid up in bed.
Mm-hmm. I can't tell if this is, like, when I don't want to go to a meeting and I'm just like, oh, I am ill. Or if it's, like, when I have a really bad migraine or, like, the flu, and I'm like, oh, I am ill.
My instinct is that it's meant to be the second one, but there's a part of me that loves the first of just, like, these magician priests are like, he's not gonna get it. Like, I like the idea of the magician priest realizing, like, oh, God's got our number. Like, we're not gonna win this one.
And also, they've spent four generations or whatever, and, like, the previous time, just having allotments from the state for being priests. And so they're used to, like, not having to try very hard.
We will have a conversation around the rigors of religious leadership offline.
I like that this requires human help for no obvious reason. And also that it is like, hey, did you know if you put lots of bad things into the air that people are surrounded with, it will cause them to have bad reactions to it? Hint at our entire ecosystem.
Yeah. Like, we had algal blooms before, and now we've got, like, heavy particulate matter in the air? Okay.
Yeah, and then God says, you have to tell Pharaoh, I've sent you some plagues, and I could do worse. And you're continuing to do bad things to my people, so it is only going to get worse for you from here on out. And says, here's what the next one's going to be, and warns them to, like, bring everybody inside to protect them from the hail.
Oh, yeah, this is one where the officials of Pharaoh can be protected from it. So, like, the ones who, quote, feared the word of the Lord, end quote, hurried their slaves and livestock off to a secure place.
Right. Nora, did you have thought about this one?
I think that, like, sometimes when I look at the plagues, like, very quickly, I'm like, ah, it's hail, like, you know, it's bad, da, 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 da. But, like, it is, like, such catastrophic weather that is, like, very real, especially in, like, contemporary climate anxiety. And also, I feel so conflicted about the plagues generally, right? Of the need of an expression of power towards liberation, right? The fact that it feels in some ways that God artificially ups the drama and the violence in order to show God's own power, which is, like, iffy for me in a bunch of ways. But also, there's something so evocative of it that works for me. This way in which, like, the world revolts against injustice. Yeah. Especially because it's, like, hail that Egypt has never seen since it became a country, like, is explicitly used as some phrasing in this. This is a difference of kind. Like, there needs to be upheaval in order for a better status quo to emerge. But it also still doesn't care about the everyday Egyptian, so it's difficult.
Although this one sort of does a little bit, right? In that, like, there is a warning this time.
True.
Like, we have the plagues are only going to get worse, and this time there is a warning of, you should all go inside. And the people who listen and do go inside, it regards those people as safe. Like, it says they are brought into safety. And I guess we don't know when it says they brought their slaves and livestock indoors. We're not clear, or at least I'm not clear. I don't know if either of you did research on this particular point, whether slaves is supposed to be all Israelites, whether that's supposed to include Egyptians as well. Who's being at risk there?
That's a good question.
I did not look into that, but it is worth doing some deeper reading.
Yeah, we'll have to check it out. Okay, and then Pharaoh, after the hail, says, I was wrong, and my people were wrong, and we really need the hail to stop. And Moshe says, so I'll go, and I'll ask God, and the thunder and hail will stop, but I don't know if you're really, truly respectful enough, and, like, a lot of the foodstuffs have been ruined, but, yeah, I don't know if you're there yet.
Including flax, which is used to make linen. So, like, the linen crop for the year was destroyed.
Mm-hmm. But there's some that are still around. It says, like, the wheat is still there because what didn't ripen yet, so it wasn't destroyed. Mm-hmm. And Pharaoh still, right after this, hardens his heart again, and that is the end of the Parsha.
Yeah.
Ooh, closing thoughts or questions before we move on to the rating.
I mean, we're in it.
We're in it. I love how this entire Parsha is pretty much contained in, like, two scenes and a song from Prince of Egypt. Like, this is a big part of the story.
Yeah, and a long period of time. Like, it doesn't happen
like
in,
months,
like, a week.
Right?
Yeah.
This is a Parsha that I actually haven't gone terribly deep on in the past. When I was working at RIT, I would often do a weekly drash, but this always happens during the winter break, so students weren't around, so we didn't talk about it, so I didn't have a reason to go back and look at it very deep.
Oh, no.
And it's really, there's so much going on that is kind of great storytelling for all of its other flaws, potentially, theologically, and all the difficulties that I think it raises up, right? Like, the question of why we hold on to what we hold on to is always very interesting to me, and, like, this is a very evocative narrative of, like, the world revolting, right, against injustice, and it's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to do a rating.
Great. Okay, sure.
This is a toughie. So do you want it to be Nora or Jazz?
I'm not a coward. I can handle an unbound scale.
You're not a coward. Yes. Beautiful. Okay. So there are two axes here. One is size of hail, and two is number of hailstones. So, like, ranging from little piddly ball bearings to, like, I don't know, a cantaloupe or something. And from, like, the occasional plink plonk to just, like, constant hailing. What would you rate this chapter, Nora?
I think I would give this probably about, like, golf ball sized, but, like, in a Rochester storm.
So I've never been to Rochester, New York. You're going to have to elaborate that a little bit for me.
It is a lovely city that is also a frozen place that tries to slowly kill all of its residents.
Yes. Okay. So, that is what I've heard.
There's a lot going on the entire time. It's notable, right? But it's not like huge impact each piece. It's kind of the continual, there's so much going on that I feel its really strength comes from.
Ooh.
Yeah.
From the repetition of
and the ways that those formulas start to change.
In some ways. And the intensification. Yeah.
I think that's my favorite type of hail, property damage aside. Just like golf balls and a lot of them over time.
Fighting back against the power that be, not with dynamite, but just with hailstones.
Who's next? Who's next?
I think Nora's next, because you answered that
one. Sure, so I guess this is going to Jazz then, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, so one thing that we didn't dig into is this little bit of funkiness that happens with the word Tsvardeya and Tsvardim for frogs, which my mother, when I was 5 years old, made me write a midrash about.
Tell us.
Oh, well, so it's actually incorrect because there isn't really a significant difference in that pluralizing. But long story short, 5-year-old Nora thought that it was one big frog that exploded into thousands of smaller frogs.
I love that.
Yes.
Which is great and like an adorable story about me, and so much worse with the end bit of how that plague ends of like just frog corpses stacked on top of each other.
Yeah.
All this to say, out of an incalculable number of frogs, how many frogs would you rate this parsha?
Oh, so I got the open-ended scale. Okay, we're just doing difficult scales around all week.
I wasn't going to come here and not do that. Like...
I feel like I've been hit with one of those like John Green what size is your infinity questions.
Okay. you know that the field of abstract mathematics exists, right? You know that John Green didn't invent that. He was just pretentious about it, I say, as somebody with one of the limited edition Fault in Our Stars audiobooks.
Ha.
I'm not going to say my signed copy isn't on my bookshelf right now, so...
Great. Okay,
Look, we were all 16 once, okay?
I've been in more embarrassing fandoms.
I was 21.
Okay, I was at least a teenager. I would say out of an incalculable number of frogs, I would give this... Yeah... A several palace courtyards full of frogs, living ones.
By area or by volume?
By volume. Okay. They're just all there, squirming and alive. And I would do that because I think that this... Look, there's not a lot of narrative, but there is a lot of pathos and power to it. And I both struggle with and really resonate with the idea of the plagues. And they're so visceral and, like, such powerful symbolism. And I like the fact that you're overwhelming them by just bringing more, like, life into it. So I like the idea of the rating is enough frogs to overwhelm our oppressors. You know what I mean? Like,
good.
Sorry, excuse me as I change my Twitter display name.
Great.
I'm going to have the paired Twitter display name, which is a countable infinity of frogs.
Great.
Currently, it's even if our enemies are the gods themselves, because I've been playing Fire Emblem Three Houses. Sorry for all the digressions.
But just a shout out, my current display name is My Rashi, My Rambam, and Me.
Yeah, I know, I love it. So good. So that's mine. Okay, and Lulav out.
Hurt me.
I was just going to go so simple. Out of one river full of blood, how much blood would you rate this parsha?
Okay. I love that. I would rate this parsha. Wow. You gave me one of the, like, plagues that I'm the most conflicted about.
Ooh.
Is it algae? Is it blood? Also, poisoning water supplies is not the best. No. Anyway, point is, I would say 7 megatons of phytoplankton and 10 gallons of blood. Because there are a couple of real good nuggets in here where we get kind of the, like, interplay of people that we've come to expect from the Yosef story.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly, it's a lot of algae. And I love it, but it is kind of repetitive.
I will say literary criticism is not my field, but there's some Joseph Cotton Campbell stuff going on here also. Just kind of derivative.
Good. I'm so glad.
So there's more to say about this maybe when we finish the plagues, but I do just want to say, because that's what this parsha is all about, that I have really conflicted feelings about the plagues in several directions, and that I really wrestle with as a thing, that like lots of social justice spaces around Passover are like, here are 10 modern plagues. And then they list like 10 bad things that are happening in the world related to a particular subject. And I don't like it because, like, sometimes last year I went to one and they were like, here are 10 plagues related to immigration. And they listed 10 bad things that are happening to immigrants. And I don't appreciate it because I think it implicitly frames immigrants as our enemies and aggressors, since that is the context in which we have plagues. And that, like, I really appreciate that we acknowledge the plagues as really bad things, that we, like, don't take joy in the bad things that happen to other people. But yeah. I do think we do have to keep them in the context of, like, they were necessary for us to get free and not, like, a tool that we used and that we are therefore morally responsible for also and have to grapple with.
Mm-hmm.
And not like, and here are bad things that are happening in the world that we don't like. You know, like, that's a different thing. I'm getting off my soapbox now. We are moving into continuity corner, and I just want to highlight my friend Dana Krieger the other day texted me and said I was reading a book, and it was a George R. R. Martin book, and he made up a reason for how Cain can take a wife, which shouldn't make sense because there's no other people around yet.
Okay.
Do you want to guess what the fictional explanation was?
So Nora can't see the document, and I want her to guess.
Sorry, so this is going back to how Cain is able to have kids. So what's funny is this was my B'nai Mitzvah Parsha.
What?
Literally, this was the Maftir. This is what I read, was Cain's lineage.
Okay.
I hated it because it's okay. Like, why do I have the most boring part of all of the beginning of Bereishit?
I'm waiting with such I mean, great bated breath.
This is a George R. R. Martin thing?
It sure is.
Someone did a murder again, and then bad politics. I don't know. I'm trying so hard now. Dragons. There, I'm going with dragons. Final answer.
You are honestly pretty close. His answer was vampires. They're vampires.
Shout out to the improv game I once played where Cain was portrayed as the longest living international assassin.
That's great.
Oh my god.
Also, because Dana sent it to me, I looked it up more, and apparently there's like a little bit of a history. Like, there's some other video game, maybe White Wolf? I don't really know.
Vampire the Masquerade.
But anyway, also calls vampires Cainanites or something to that effect. Or like...
Yeah, Cain's the first vampire in that universe.
Yeah, so there's that.
That's amazing. I love that. That's also... that's so great.
So, but I have two other things that I wanted to say in our continuity corner. We have started to get listener mail from people who I don't know personally, which I am thrilled and delighted about. Really happy to have gotten stuff from, like, friends like Dana, but I also am super excited to have things from listeners. And this one was from Ethan, who wrote in with what they called a Noah conspiracy theory, which is just a great midrash about how Noah is a trans man.
Oh, okay. I thought this was going, like, bigger Noah directions, where there are actually two Noachim, and one of them is just slightly taller.
No, but there's this verse, right, chapter 5, verse 29, that is in English, "This shall relieve us from our wrongdoings and from the toil of our hands, from the ground that God cursed." And Ethan looked at it and was like, Well, who named Noah? How would they know that he would be able to do this? And, like, what did he do? And Ethan was like, well, they couldn't know all of those things about him if he was being named at birth, so he must have been named later and gotten this name later. And you know who gets named later? That's us. That's us. And actually, I'm going to link people, I think, to this whole thing because it's great. But also, there's this addition here that usually we hear more about people's wives when they have children, like at least a little bit, but we don't for Noah's wife, just this verse that says, Noah begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And then when we were exchanging verses about it, I appreciated this bit that reinterprets it as the reason his wife's name isn't mentioned isn't because of misogyny, but just because, like, she didn't give birth to them, so she's not relevant to the begotting part.
Okay.
Their explanation is that he gave birth to them. Yes.
So, show of hands, who thinks that Noah's wife was a cute trans girl? What do you think?
I'm down.
I like the T for T angle.
I'm very much like a queer who reads lots of Torah, but not someone who finds queer takes on Torah often. That was delightful.
I wrote back and I was like, this is really fun. I have a quibble with one line of it, which is, before we get the line that says, like, and he called his name Noah, which is where you base the him being named later in life bit, the line before that says, when Lamech had lived 182 years, he begot a son, which contextually suggests that Lamech named Noah. I was like, so, but I like your reasoning for why it's later in life. Like, I think that that makes sense and tracks. Ergo, Noah is a trans man, but his dad is really supportive and helps name him later in life.
Good. Also, he could have been like, here's a list of three names I like. Choose your favorite.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was really fun. And also, Ethan noted that the interpretation about the wife, and that Ethan works with a chavruta who is a queer cis woman, and so that it helps them to learn with her because, like, they come at it from slightly different angles, and she gets to pick up on stuff like that that sort of highlight more of the perspective of specifically some of the women in the text.
Yay.
Yeah. That was really cool. Anyway, Lou Love, your piece.
Number two in the mailbox, or I guess number three if we include the vampires thing, is we were talking about how fatness used to be viewed as, generally speaking, a very good thing, and now it's a little more mixed. And my friend Halka, who you may recognize from sharing the characterization of Enkidu in the Epic of Gilgamesh, sent me a link to a book, which is Fearing the Black Body, The Racial Origins of Fat Phobia by Sabrina Strings. And they haven't read it personally, but it was very heartily recommended to them. And just based on the thesis, which is that a lot of the American and maybe not American, I don't know, take on fatness being bad comes from fear of black people and, like, denigration of them. So, yeah, that's just a potential source for anybody who wanted to do more reading on that.
Great. I mean, not great that it's like that, but
we'll no, link. Horrible, in fact.
We'll link to it. Okay, and then one more thing we got was from Callum, who wrote in and said that he had, when he was younger, an English translation of this book called Sefer HaYashar, which I don't know if either of you had ever heard of before, but I had never heard of it before.
Oh, yeah, the Book of the Yashar.
Is that a no, you've never heard of it before?
No, I never, sorry. I am constitutionally unable to admit when I don't know a thing. I'm working on it.
Anyway, and that includes a bunch of Midrash, and I appreciated this because Callum was like, I'm realizing from your podcast that I literally had forgotten how little narrative there is in the actual Torah compared to the Midrash. Which is great. Anyway, and so Callum was like, I often get the urge to interrupt with some Midrash Sheen that I remember, so I'm just sending them in. And so in Miketz, there's a Midrash that Yaakov explicitly told the 10 sons to split up and enter the city at 10 gates, and a guard on the wall noticed that they had split up and watched them regather together once they had entered the city to explain why Yosef had reason to accuse them of being spies. Also, to add to the melodrama in this parsha and next, every time Yosef Joseph has to have a small cry, it's made explicit that he just walks out of the room mid-conversation to go to his bedroom and cry, and then just walks back in like nothing happened.
As the youth would say, big mood?
Hey, Yosef, where'd you just go? I've been right here the entire time. What are you talking about?
Yeah. Also, there's one more from the next Parsha that said, Yosef asked Binyamin to come sit with him during the meal since they both had, quote, no other brother. And they had a conversation about what happened to Binyamin's brother since he's like, my one whole brother or whatever was lost, even though I am not endorsing this method of being like, my real brother is my biological full sibling. Anyway, but so Binyamin was known for being a skilled astrologer. He brought out a map of the stars and asked him if the stars could find his lost brother, which inevitably led to Binyamin reading in the stars that Yosef was in the same room as him, which is just very sweet. Oh, yeah, and then they're arguing, Yosef and Yehuda get into a whole thing over whether he could keep Binyamin as a slave, where Yosef says he could set the entire Egyptian army on them, and Yehuda responds with, oh, yeah, well, just the two of us killed an entire city.
That's not something to be proud of, my guy.
No! And Yosef literally tells him he should just sell Binyamin for the divining cup, just like he sold another brother for silver.
Wait, literally meet me in the pit.
Not cool, man. I told you that in confidence.
Yeah.
Jazz, can you take us to the close?
Yep. Thank you for listening to Kosher Queers for this wild episode. But if you like what you've heard, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/kosherqueers, which will give you bonus content and help us keep making this for you. You can also follow us on Twitter at kosherqueers or like us on Facebook at kosherqueers or email us your questions, comments, and concerns at kosherqueers@gmail.com, like our listeners did today. And please spread the word about our podcast. Our artwork is by the talented Lior Gross. Our music is courtesy of the fabulous band Brivola, whose work you can find on Bandcamp. Go buy their album. They're great. Our sound production this week is done by our excellent audio editor, Ezra Faust. I'm Jazz Twersky, and you can find me at WordNerdKnitter on Twitter. I recorded this audio on the traditional lands of the Lenape people.
I'm Lila Varno, and you can find me at SpaceTruck6 on Twitter, or yell at me at PalmLiker. I recorded this audio on the traditional lands of the Wapekute and Anishinaabeg.
Nora, where can people find you?
I'm Nora. You can find me at Nora Chernoff on Twitter. And I also recorded this on the traditional land of the Lenape people.
Nora, thank you so much. You're a delight.
Thank you for having me.
Have a lovely queer Jewish day.
This week's gender is cloudy ambivalence.
This week's pronouns are something, I don't know.